Chapter 80. He awoke to the soft, synthesized sounds of wind chimes dancing in a light breeze. He reached his short left arm across to the nightstand, tapping the sleep button. The second time the gently ringing chimes sounded, they got his full attention, his eyes snapping open. He shut the alarm, slipped on his glasses, checked the time, and swung his pale white legs off the bed. He surrendered to nature, his little body and face distorting, as he stretched the sleep out of his muscles and joints. His shoulder ached, as it always did in the morning. He sometimes wondered if the real Jesse Stone's shoulder ached this way in the morning. At the moment, his focus was elsewhere, though he was sure Jesse Stone's focus and attention were squarely on him. If they weren't, he was about to make sure Jesse's focus was squarely on him. Hopping out of bed, he smiled at the thought and in anticipation of the kill. 30 minutes later, cup of coffee in hand, he went out to the valet on duty, gave the Mexican kid his parking stub and a 10-spot. He said, "Please have my car at the East Hotel exit. Leave the keys in the ignition, please." He looked at his watch. "Have it there in precisely 20 minutes. That's at 9:15. If the car is there, as I ask, there'll be another 10 in it for you."
"Yes, sir. 9:15, the kid said, throwing his thumb at the east side of the building. "It'll be right there where you ask."
He went back up to his room, blind to the activity in the lobby, blind to the men and women in their athletic gear, heading out to the running trails across the way. Blind to the mother struggling with her 2-year-old son, whose stomping feet and angry tears were just the first steps toward a full-blown tantrum. Upstairs, he hung the Do Not Disturb sign from the outside door handle, closed the door, clicked the security lock closed, and swung the triangular door latch over the little arm and knob attached to the jamb. He removed the lamp and a clock radio from the nightstand, placed them on the bed, and wriggled the nightstand to a spot a few feet behind the French doors that opened onto the room's small balcony. He repeated the steps with the nightstand from the other side of the bed, hefting the second nightstand on its side atop the first one. He swung open the French doors and stepped out onto the balcony. He looked across to the adjoining building, the residential tower of the Park Mansion complex, counted 9 floors up and 2 windows to his left. He looked up to the sky. It was a clear day, and there might be some glare off the windows, but not enough to trouble him. He retrieved his rifle from the black fishing equipment case, the magazine and scope from his duffel bag. He affixed the scope to the rifle, threaded his arm through the strap, placed his elbow on the second nightstand, and lined up the shot. He made minor adjustments to the scope. When he was satisfied, he unthreaded his arm from the rifle strap, clicked the magazine into the weapon, and laid it down on the bed. He checked his watch and retrieved yet another one of his many prepaid cell phones. He dialed Jesse Stone's number. It took only 2 rings for Jesse to pick up.
"Jesse Stone."
"Good morning, Jesse," he said. "Tick-tock, tick-tock. Wedding bells are almost ready to chime. Consider today a free preview of things coming your way. And when you're contemplating the damage done, remember that it all comes back."
"Damage? What?"
"It's rude to interrupt. I don't like rudeness. Remember that. And remember that if you had only let things be, neither of us would be here in Vineland Park today. How many people are dead already because you just couldn't let things alone? Tick-tock, Jesse, tick-tock."
He clicked off, undid the guts of the phone, stomped on it, and dropped it in the toilet. He checked his watch once more, picked up the rifle, and rethreaded his arm through the strap. He lined up the shot again. This wasn't about precision. If he hit her, all the better. If not, it would serve to reinforce his message about minding her manners, and to remind her that she would never be free of him. That she would always be his prisoner, tied to that workbench in the old building in West Dallas. In any case, the shot and the rest of what was about to unfold was for Jesse Stone's benefit and, in its way, for for Jen, a sort of wedding gift to her. He smiled that smile of his, remembering just how beautiful Jen had looked as she tried on her wedding gown. He waited. He knew that he probably wouldn't feel the attaché case explode on the 10th floor. It was meant to be more lightning than thunder anyway, a means to distract and misdirect, not to inflict much damage or do harm. What he knew was that the fire alarm would ring immediately in the wake of the explosion, and that would be his cue. And there it was, the shrill electronic shrieking, the grating chirping, and the announcement from speakers mounted in the hallway to evacuate the building in an orderly fashion, using the stairwells only and not the elevators. He put in his earplugs. He worked the bolt, placing a cartridge into the rifle's chamber, took aim, and just as he moved his trigger finger off the trigger guard and onto the trigger, a silhouette appeared against the curtain in the window across the way. He couldn't believe his good fortune, and did not hesitate. The glass shattered across the way, and the silhouette was no longer visible. The shot was loud, he knew, and under any other set of circumstances would have attracted unwanted attention. But with the alarm sounding, the announcement repeating, people running for their lives, no one was going to stop to investigate. By the time anyone did, he would be long gone. When he climbed down the east exit stairs, the car was where it was supposed to be, but the Mexican kid was nowhere in sight. He snickered, because he hadn't meant to give the kid the extra $10 in any case.